Today is the fifth day of this March 2015 seven-day session. And we'll return to the letters and talks of 12th century Chinese Zen master Da Wei from the book titled Swampland Flowers. Here's a letter to a secretary, Lu. Since we parted, I don't know whether or not you can avoid being carried away by external objects in your daily activities as you respond to circumstances, whether or not you can put aside your heap of legal documents as you look through them, whether or not you can act freely when you meet with people, whether or not you engage in vain thinking when you're where it's peaceful and quiet, whether or not you are thoroughly investigating this matter without any distracted thoughts. I love this phrase, whether or not you can put aside your heap of legal documents as you look through them. Being unattached to them, not captive to them, maintaining awareness. So he's, another, this again, the Chinese indirect, I don't know whether or not, we might say, can you avoid being carried away by external objects in your daily activities? Can you act freely when you meet with people? Are you engaging in vain thinking when you're where it's peaceful and quiet? Ironically, people these days aren't as much in danger when they're doing nothing, when they're somewhere where it's peaceful and quiet, of engaging in vain thinking, because they always have their smartphone to go to. Thus, old Yellowface, he's referring to the Buddha, has said, when the mind does not vainly grasp at past things, does not long for things in the future, and does not dwell on anything in the present, then you realize fully that the three times are all empty and still. And Da Wei replies, goes on, you shouldn't think about past events, whether good or bad. If you think, that obstructs the path. You shouldn't consider future events. To consider them is crazy confusion. Present events are right in front of you. Whether they're pleasant or unpleasant, don't fix your mind on them. But if you do fix your mind on them, it will disturb your heart. Just take everything in its time, responding according to circumstances, and you will naturally accord with this principle. So this basic teaching that's so difficult to do, saying don't grasp at past things, don't grasp at future thoughts, and don't get stuck in thinking about anything that's happening right now. H.L. Mencken said, we are here and it is now. Further than that, all human knowledge is moonshine. Shouldn't consider future events. To consider them as crazy confusion. Yeah, when you reflect on it, to be dwelling in thoughts about the future, how deluded is that? Or chewing on things from the past. And even with present, the present events. Don't fix your mind on them. He goes on, unpleasant situations are easy to handle. Pleasant situations are hard to handle. For that which goes against one's will, it boils down to one word, patience. Settle down and reflect a moment, and in a little while it's gone. These are the unpleasant situations. Then he says, it's pleasant situations that truly give you no way to escape. Like pairing magnet and iron, unconsciously this and that come together in one place. Even inanimate objects are thus. How much the more so for those acting in ignorance, with their whole beings making a living within it. In this world, if you have no wisdom, you will be dragged unknowing and unawares by that ignorance into a net. Once inside the net, won't it be difficult to look for a way out? This is why an early sage said, having entered the world, leave the world completely. I think it was maybe a Christian mystic who said to be in the world, but not of the world. You have no wisdom, you'll be dragged unknowing and unawares by that ignorance into a net. We can so misuse our capacity to be absorbed in things. We want to, of course, be absorbed in the practice we're working on. But when we're out and about in our daily lives, we can get absorbed in things that only captivate us. We're held, literally held captive by the things that we can be gawking at on our screens or in movies or anything. So easily can lose track of time in the most trivial kinds of things. In a way, these our ability to get lost in things is just confirmation of the capacity of this mind to lose itself, to forget the self. But it's what in Buddhism is sometimes called the near enemy of concentration. It's being absorbed by the wrong stuff that will not lead to any wisdom. Whereas finding that kind of absorption in this formless practice we're working on, whether it's a breath or a koan or anything else, in that we have the capacity to overcome these habit forces and to see. That's using our ability to concentrate in a conscious, directed way, rather than just being held captive by the many beguiling things that we're exposed to in our daily lives. I have a passage here from Thoreau. I believe that the mind can be permanently profaned by the habit of attending to trivial things, so that all our thoughts become tinged with triviality. We should treat our minds, that is, ourselves, as innocent, ingenuous children whose guardians we are, and be careful what subjects we thrust on their attention. Read not the times, read the eternities. Conventionalities are at length as bad as impurities. Even the facts of science may dust the mind by their dryness, unless they are in a sense effaced each morning, or rather rendered fertile by the dews of fresh and living truth. Knowledge does not come to us by details, but in flashes of light from heaven. Yes, every thought that passes through the mind helps to wear and tear it and to deepen the ruts. This is could be right out of a Buddhist text, that the way we can misuse the mind and just perpetuate our attachment to worldly things is not to say that people have to become monks or give up all their electronic devices or pleasures, but just to know that we pay a price. There is a toll on our getting involved with non-essentials. And he closes this letter to his secretary by saying, "What I've been talking about thus far is all my personal life experience. Even right now, I practice just like this." Right now, even after deep realization, he says, "I practice like this. I hope that you will take advantage of your physical strength and health and also enter this stable equilibrium. Take advantage of our physical strength and health while we have it. While we have it. We won't always have it. None of us. Here's a good one for householders today, as much as they were in the 12th century, as much as it was, this letter. "Having read your letter carefully, I have come to know that you are unremitting in your conduct, that you are not carried away by the press of official duties, that in the midst of swift-flowing streams you vigorously examine yourself. Far from being lax, your aspiration to the way grows ever more firm as time goes on. You have fulfilled my humble wishes solidly and profoundly." And now the other side. "Nevertheless, worldly passions are like a blazing fire. When will they ever end? Right in the midst of the hubbub, you mustn't forget the business of the bamboo chair and reed cushion." This was and perhaps in some places in China still is what they used for zazen and the zendo, the bamboo chair and the reed cushion. But he's saying, right in the midst of the hubbub, you mustn't forget this business, which means meditation, inactivity. Meditation activity doesn't mean closing your eyes and stopping whatever you're doing. It means noticing when the mind is wandering and getting back to your practice or what is right at hand. He says, "Usually to meditate, you set your mind on a still concentration point, but you must be able to use it right in the midst of the hubbub. If you have no strength amidst commotion, after all, it's as if you never made any effort in stillness. So the link that he and so many other masters, most notably Hakuin, these are the two guys I think of, and I think of ones who emphasized maintaining awareness in the midst of activity, is Hakuin and Dahui. That the link between the sitting and the active awareness must be there. In order to be mindful and aware in our daily activities, especially the stressful ones, we have to sit. Don't anyone fool yourself. You're not going to be as aware and alert and responsive in your daily activities if you haven't sat that day, or if you don't sit regularly. Continues, I have heard that there was some complicated situation in the past, and now you are experiencing the sadness of the outcome. You're alone, and you do not dare to hear your fate. You know, having heard what we did about the political dangers in Dawei's day, he may be alluding to this, the recipient of this letter having gotten trouble with the serious political trouble, facing execution for all we know. If you arouse this thought, then it will obstruct the way. Well, any thought. But maybe he means if you dwell in your dreary predicament, then it will obstruct the way. An ancient worthy said, if you can recognize the inherent nature while going along with the flow, there is neither joy nor sorrow. It's a very, very advanced state to be free of both joy and sorrow. Most people, when they hear this, may say, "Well, sure, I don't want sorrow, but joy, give me that. Why wouldn't I want joy?" But Dawei here is talking about kind of a mania of being losing your center and just losing your presence of mind in what is a transitory state. Long Zen practice grants us a kind of quiet, centered joy, equanimity, and then he quotes Vimalakirti. It's like this: the high plateau does not produce lotus flowers. It is the mire of the low swamplands that produces these flowers. He says, if you consider quietude right and commotion wrong, then this is seeking the real aspect by destroying the worldly aspect, seeking nirvana, the peace of extinction, apart from birth and death. When you like the quiet and hate the hubbub, this is just the time to apply effort. Suddenly, when in the midst of hubbub, you topple the scene of quietude, that power surpasses the meditation seat and cushion by a million billion times. I think everyone can understand Dawei's point here, is that if you have the mental strength, the concentration and the mindfulness to maintain your presence of mind in the midst of stressful activity, then this is more powerful than relying on quiet and stillness to do your meditation. But this too is most of us, it takes many years to appreciate this, to understand this experientially, because it's difficult. Hakuin, he didn't say a million billion times the power surpasses the sitting meditation by a million billion. He said 10,000 times. And he continues with his theme in this next letter. Once you have achieved peaceful stillness of body and mind, you must make earnest effort. Do not immediately settle down in peaceful stillness. In the teachings, this is called the deep pit of liberation, much to be feared. You must make yourself turn freely like a gourd floating on the water, independent and free, not subject to restraints, entering purity and impurity without being obstructed or sinking down. Only then do you have a little familiarity with the school of the patch-robed monks. If you just manage to cradle the uncrying child in your arms, what's the use? Well, this is vital advice in Sesshin as well. Once you've achieved peaceful stillness of body and mind, then I would say that everyone here at this point on day 5 has achieved peaceful stillness of body and mind. Whether you know it or not, whether you believe it or not, the Sesshin has settled dramatically in these almost five days. Once that's happened, you must make earnest effort. This is what has caused so many people to fall short of doing what they came here to do, is they settle into this kind of swamp of quietude, this luscious tranquility, and they don't continue pressing more deeply into the koan, the breath. It's so seductive, this quietude. It's like wrapping oneself in a warm blanket and just going no further. It's a test of what you want. What is your priority? Or how badly do you want to realize your nature? If it's badly enough, then you won't succumb to the seductions of this calmness, stillness. If you just manage to cradle the uncrying child in your arms, what's the use? This next letter is to a Shu Tongji. This affair is like the bright sun in the blue sky, shining clearly, changeless and motionless, without diminishing or increasing. course, he's talking about this self-nature of ours, this true mind. It shines everywhere in the daily activities of everyone, appearing in everything. Though you try to grasp it, you cannot get it. Though you try to abandon it, it always remains. It is vast and unobstructed, utterly empty. Like a gourd floating on water, it cannot be reined in or held down. Since ancient times, when people, good people of the way, have attained this, they've appeared and disappeared in the sea of birth and death, able to use it fully. There is no deficit or surplus. Like cutting up sandalwood, each piece is it. So when sandalwood is cut up, each piece is equally fragrant. He's pointing to the mind of every single person hearing this. Every one of us is like the bright sun in the blue sky, shining clearly, changeless and motionless, without diminishing or increasing. It shines everywhere in the daily activities of everyone, appearing in everything. The trouble is, as we all know, is this bright sun in the blue sky becomes obscured by clouds, but the clouds are passing. The clouds just give the appearance of the sun having disappeared. It's always there. It's always shining. Couldn't get rid of this bright sun in the blue sky if you tried. Don't doubt this. We have some 50 bright suns shining in this room right now, and many more listening to this as a recording. Just must stop clinging to the clouds that drift in front of this sun. Not be deceived by these clouds that are nothing. Nothing to them. Don't make something out of these clouds, these thoughts. This is later in the same letter. When people of power, and let me say that everyone is a person of power, potentially. They can learn how to use the mind and not misuse it. When people of power want to investigate this one great affair to the end, they all break down their facades and with bold spirit draw their spines up straight. Do not go along with the feelings of others. Take your own constant point of doubt, questioning, and stick it on your forehead. Always be as if you owed someone millions with nothing to repay with when pressed for payment, fearful of humiliation by others. Only thus will you have some direction in the task of finding urgency where there is no urgency, getting busy where there is no pressure, and finding importance where there is no importance. There's a way he's urging us to mobilize these energies of ours, to use our will to get going, to avoid sinking into a kind of inertia in our practice. Work diligently day and night, while eating and drinking, when joyful or angry, in clean places or unclean places, in family gatherings, when entertaining guests, when dealing with official business in your post, when conducting a betrothal. All of these are first-class times to make efforts to arouse and alert yourself and awaken. In the old days, the military governor was able to study Chan and attain great penetration and great enlightenment while in the thick of wealth and rank. When Yang Wan Kung successfully practiced Chan, he was dwelling in the Imperial Han Lin Academy. When Chang Wu Chin studied Chan, he was the minister for transport in Kyangxi. These three elders are examples of this not destroying the worldly aspect while speaking of the real aspect. It's in quotes. When has it ever been necessary to leave wife and children, quit one's job, chew on vegetable roots, and cause pain to the body? Those of inferior aspiration shun clamor and seek quietude. Thence they enter the ghost cave of dead tree Chan, entertaining false ideas that only thus can they awaken to the way. There's a pretty good chance that Hakuin was that Da Wei reincarnated as Hakuin. There's so many similarities to their style. He continues, if you can manage not to forget the matter of birth and death, or for people working on Mu, if you can manage to maintain your concentration on Mu while in the midst of the passions of the world, then even though you do not immediately smash the lacquer bucket of ignorance, nevertheless you will have planted deep the seed wisdom of transcendental knowledge. In another lifetime you will appear and save your mental power. You won't fall into evil dispositions. You'll overcome that sinking down into the defilement of passions. This is a difference from what I can tell in my reading of both Chinese Zen and Japanese Zen, is that in Chinese Zen you do read of the masters saying, well, even if you don't get it in this lifetime, if you really apply yourself and dedicate yourself completely to this practice, then in the next lifetime you'll not be starting from square one. You'll have a good head start. From what I can remember reading in Hakuin and these other fierce Japanese masters, they don't want to give you that out. Now, this is the time. This is your chance. You could die any minute. Chinese are known, they're more practical as a people. And so we hear this, even though you don't immediately smash the lacquer bucket, still you'll have planted deep the seed wisdom of prajna. In another lifetime you will appear and go from there. I suppose for some people this could be motivating and other people not so motivating. Some people, I guess you would think, okay, the pressure's off, I'm just going to work now and do the best I can, and that could open things up for them. Other people, maybe of weaker faith, might hear of the possibility of not awakening in this lifetime and feel dispirited from that. He continues, as a gentleman of affairs, wonder how another translator would render that, as a householder, maybe. A householder who has works for a living. Your practice of the way differs greatly from mine as a home leaver. Leavers of home, monks, do not serve their parents, and they abandon all their relatives for good. With one jug and one bowl, in daily activities according to circumstances, there are not so many enemies to obstruct the way. With one mind and one intent, monks just investigate this affair thoroughly. But when a householder opens his eyes and is mindful of what he sees, there is nothing that is not an enemy spirit blocking the path. Of course, he's talking about possible distractions, attachments. If he has wisdom, he makes his meditational effort right there. As Vimalakirti said, the companions of passion are the progenitors of the Tathagatas. I fear that people will destroy the worldly aspect to seek the real aspect. This is, Vimalakirti was also known as one of the great householders to come to deep realization. And then again, he also made a comparison. It's like the high plateau not producing lotus flowers. It's the mud of the low-lying marshlands that produces these flowers. It is getting into the muck of interpersonal relations with people at work and family, kids and in-laws and financial pressures and so forth. If you can penetrate through right here, as those three elders did, your power will surpass that of us monks by 20-fold. How so? We monks are on the outside breaking in. Householders are on the inside breaking out. The power of one on the outside breaking in is weak. The power of one on the inside breaking out is strong. Strong means that what is opposed is heavy, so in overturning it, there is power. It's like running with leg weights. Weak means what is opposed is light, so in overturning it, there is little power. And then he says, though there is strong and weak in terms of power, what is opposed is the same. What we have to contend with is the same. Of course, here in our Sangha, there are no true monks in the sense of what they were in ancient China or ancient Japan, who have cut off all relations with family and maintaining vows of, having taken vows of celibacy and secluded in monasteries. So really, when he addresses so-called gentlemen of affairs and gentlewomen of affairs, he's talking about all of us. All right, rather than starting another letter, we'll stop here now and recite the four vows.